You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of White People Won't Save You. This is the podcast where we deconstruct these white savior films and recontextualize them through a Black and POC lens. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Clark.
And I'm the other one, Cameron Mason.
And we've got an episode that I'm excited about because we've got a movie that I have many questions about and I'm curious for some answers. And we have a guest that I'm also excited to talk about because their recently released book, which is entitled Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. This is Fatima Gilliam. Fatima, how's it going?
Great. I'm really excited to be here with you guys. Thank you for having me on, Jordan and Cameron.
Appreciate
it. Thanks for
coming. And love the book. And I think part of what you talk about in it, which is, you know, obviously interesting to us, is a little bit about the white savior trope. And I'm just curious, you know, in your opinion, like, these movies, we talk about them all the time, are Oscar nominated, Oscar winning, you know, like they are movies that captivate people's attention. And for better or worse, in a lot of situations are where people form opinions about race and people form opinions about specific people, whether they've seen a movie like The Help or they've seen a movie like Green Book and they think they've learned history, or whether they've, you know, watched. Because you know, there's white savory movies, and then there's just generally movies where there's scary black people, there's scary brown people, you know, there's all kinds of things that are kind of obviously dog whistle, you know, intended. And whether you find yourself to be a very liberal person or somebody who could see through all of that stuff, like, it seeps in. And, you know, for you, when you're thinking about race and specifically, you know, how In your experience, you've seen a lot of people maybe kind of walk into some stuff because they had assumptions based on not real life experiences, but things they've seen in film or television and other places. Like, how big of an impact do things like the white savior trope and other things have just on how white people navigate and view race?
I think it's significant. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do in my book, in Race Rules, is I'm trying to get people to expand how they think about race and racism and how they define it. And one of the biggest things that I think is difficult to overcome is white exceptionalism, right? And I think that white exceptionalism overlays with the white savior trope, because at the end of the day, it's like the white, you know, white people in America don't want to think that they have a personal hand in perpetuating tropes, stereotypes, racism, white supremacy, and even white nationalism.
Well, and specifically, I think in these movies and in this movie that we're about to talk about, Invictus, oftentimes there is the white person who is racist, capital R, like full blown, like all the slurs, all the hate, you know, and it's very much like, here's this person, don't be that person. And then on the other side, you've got, say, like Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, where people are like, I want to be like her. But it's like, but you don't want to be like Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, because that's don't do that. Right. And so, you know, for you, when you think about, like, what are some of the things that white people often maybe assume, you know, in conversations or interactions with people of color, where they think, oh, you know, like, I'm going to be one of the good ones, the allies that, you know, they can talk to me about it, because I know, you know, there's a passage that you love from the book that speaks to trying to talk to black people or people of color about race, and maybe assuming that yeah, we all want to have that conversation all the time, every day, no matter the context,
and not realizing that they are wearing us out.
Yes.
You know, like, you know, it's like, we can't all be the Encyclopedia of Negranica, right? Yeah. Like, that where they just come up to us all the time and wanting to ask us, like, you know, sort of like data dump your pain and your experiences, and for their momentary, like when they just want to parachute in, helicopter out of the topic for a moment, rip open all your pain, dive in there, and just like, you know, swim around in it just so that they can learn something, which they honestly could have learned on their own.
Yes.
If they proactively took it upon themselves to do some research, but instead they just want to roll up on you, ambush you, and ask you a whole bunch of inappropriate questions.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, you know, which very much mirrors with my, you know, race rule number 22, where the rule is it's not personal when people of color don't want to talk to you about race.
Yes. And I feel like, I mean, Cameron has shared certain experiences. Cameron, briefly relay your play experience where a white woman turned to you after after watching a particular play.
Yes. Man, I wish I could remember the title of the play now. I've got it lodged out of my head. But I went to go see a play at the Public by Susan Lloyd Parks, who, if you're familiar, is a bit of a provocateur in her writings. Her recent play was about a group of friends, one of which who was Black, and in an altercation with the police where they felt unsafe, came up with a kind of clause with his white friend that he would be his slave, so that in situations with the police or something like that, or a party that's like more powerful than him, he could just say, well, you can take this up with my master. My master is at home, or my master's here. You could talk to my friend and he'll vouch for me. Right. So fine play. Everybody gets up and claps at the end. And I'm sitting next to this white woman who's very enthralled, more enthralled than the average theater goer. By the end of the play, everybody's standing up and clapping. And then, you know, we're all looking for our seats and or for the exit. And she looked for my arm. She looked for a deep hug and took it. a deep hug, too. She was in there for a couple seconds.
You
and
bonded,
then...
Cameron. You bonded with a stranger that you had never spoken to that somehow you needed to give a hug to.
The best part was at the end when we de-embraced, she looked at me and just said, I don't know why I did that. And there we are. And there we are. Just confusion. Just confusion. That's what's left in the middle. That's what's left in the middle of race relations. Just confusion.
Yes.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, when you ask for an example, I feel like every day is an example. So it's like hard to always just right. like draw on the one, because they're just happening all the damn time.
Yes.
You know, where it's that, or, you know, I mean, a lot of times people don't realize I'm Black. Right. And then, so there's that aspect of it. And then when they do, like, I remember one time, like when I was really young and I was like at a party in junior high or something. And, you know, and then they were like, oh, Fatima, you're Black. You can teach us how to dance. No, I can't teach you how to dance. First of all, well, yes, I know how to dance, but I'm like, not going to say that to you right now. But, but why am I now somehow instructor to the fact that I have to watch a whole bunch of people play, you know, have like body Tourette's on the dance floor?
Right. It's their confusion. It's like the collective white confusion at racism. Like, what is this murk? What is this we're all murking through right now? And the first person they come across, the first Black person they come across is, they have the answer. They have the answer. And before the question, right, in your case, the question, or in my case, before the play is over, before the hug is over even, we're exhausted.
Yes.
Exhausted also from unconsensual touching of our hair.
Yep.
You know, we're going to get to that. Especially when my hair is curly, you know, because it's done at the moment. And then when it's curly, I mean, I guess, yeah, I don't feel too badly about this, but I definitely have had many times in my life where a white woman will come up to me who clearly has a Black child and then will ask me, can you please tell me what to do or help me figure out how to do my child's hair? First of all, I don't even know you, lady. Okay. And I'm not about to do a tutorial. And maybe you should have thought about that beforehand. But we all know whenever we see what could be a mixed child who's a girl with crazy hair, you're like, white mama. Yeah.
Instantly, you can instantly tell. And you know, yeah. They got questions like, do the brushes have different names? Are they coded? Is there a color code? Like a fineness to the tip? I'm not sure. Help, please. And we got out of slavery. We got out of Jim Crow. We got out of sharecropping. We got out of finally on the other side of supposed civil rights to finally stop helping. And they still need help.
Well, come on, wait, Cameron. In Florida, as you know, they are teaching the truth, which is that slavery was a job training program.
Yeah. You know, it's just you got to put in like
400
years. And
we got paid because we got housing.
I'm not privy to this, and I am terrified. I am now terrified.
It's a 400-year internship, Cameron, that you just, you know, once you get through that, you know, initial groundwork.
Doc, I'm looking for that promotion. I need that generational wealth. I'm looking for that. I need the next step.
Here's the question. The promotion that you get hopefully doesn't mean like you're the Sam Jackson character in Django Unchained.
Yeah.
That's true. I want to work inside, but I don't want to work in the house. You know what I mean?
I mean, these hands weren't really made for picking cotton. Like, yeah. I just don't want to have all those like thorn, you know, things in there, but you know.
Got a really nice lotion, right? Got a really nice hand lotion there, Vaseline, if you will.
But I mean, if we want to break it down too, it's like, well, how did I get light skinned? Okay.
That part I was also going to say, I mean, I'm sure, you know, but the hair is a conversation, but also, you know, shea butter is a whole other conversation that white people like to try to investigate. You know, they want to know the secrets. Just stick to the jargons. But
we can't give away too much game on this. Come on, we can't give away too much game, Jordan.
Well, let's get to, speaking of games, today's movie is all about the game of rugby. It is 2009's Invictus, and this was a movie that I like was in my periphery. Like, I literally before Fatima, you got to us with your decision, like after an NBA game last week, this was on TNT. You know, like it started pulling.
Oh, Invictus was?
Yeah, like it started coming.
Oh,
up
I didn't even know, like, that. I had to, like, you know, okay, full disclosure, I like looked at the list of films that you guys had. And then I was like, oh, okay, what, you know, what is there that I haven't seen or that I want to see again? And then I was like, okay, Invictus. And then I looked on every streaming platform and I was like, I have to pay to see the movie, a 15-year-old movie. And so you know what I did? I was like, you know, on principle, I just can't do that. So I went to the public library. Smart. And I checked out a DVD. Yes.
Smart.
And
when I did that,
I walked out and I was like, I love the public library. I love the
Support
public library.
Support your public library. Yeah, that's right.
If you get nothing else from this episode, just go to the library, please. It's a beautiful place.
I'll say too, go to the library for, you know, to support them. And if you go to the library, ask them if they have my book, Race Rules, and then request it so that it could end up in libraries across the country.
Because some people need it. A lot of people need it, actually.
I think everybody needs this book. I mean, this book is helpful for lots of people. Like, I wrote the book to white people, right? But it's really for our benefit.
Yes.
Right? For people of color, for Black people. And it's helpful for Black people and people of color in two ways too, right? So it's giving like white people advice. Mm-hmm. But then it's helpful for us because, you know, a person of color can look at that and say, you know, that really brings words to my experiences, what I've gone through. It can help them if they're having a conversation, hopefully a consensual conversation with someone around race. And then I also consider this book a please go away and leave me in peace book. You know, like when you are tired of having a conversation with someone or they keep asking you these questions, you'd be like, read this, you know, so I could go about my life. Like, oh, you want to know about cultural appropriation? You need to check out, you know, Race Rule Number, whatever, or tokenism or voting rights or taking a knee or calling the police for no reason or how to apologize. She's covered it.
Yeah.
Read that. And I got a life to live.
Cameron's that sounds like a great office Christmas gift.
Oh, totally. Totally. And I'll just say a couple other things about the book and then we can dive into the film.
Sure, sure.
But so I'll tell you a couple. So the idea for the book was like 5 years ago, I was watching the news and it was another story of a Karen going viral for calling the police for no reason. And as I watched the news story, I thought about a couple of different things. I thought about like the rinse and repeat questions that I get from friends and colleagues and what I've also, and the questions I've gotten in like my diversity consulting work. And then I also thought about the things that white people say around me when they don't realize I'm Black. And as that happened and all of these things were like floating around in my head, I thought, white people need a manual. I'm going to write a manual, you know? And so this book is about like advice. Like, so if you look at other books that have been written about race, right? So it'll be like, either it's like the memoir or somehow there's an autobiographical component to it. Mm-hmm. And through reading that, you're supposed to have some lens into what racism is and it expands your understanding. Or it's sort of like this academic book where, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe it's a little too dense, maybe it feels unapproachable, or, you know, or it's describing systems and structures and breaking down history. And then that could help somebody understand like how racism manifests and how mm-hmm. this country came to be how it is. And then what? And then what? Right? Like, so, okay, so now you understand that, but like, what are you going to do at Thanksgiving when somebody says something outlandish that's racist? What are you going to do at Thanksgiving when you're that person that says something outlandish, right? And so I wrote this book in a sort of choose your own race knowledge adventure, right? So it's like it's written for the lazy reader because I'm a lazy reader, right? So the person who just wants to hop around, like if you want to understand tokenism, you know, race rule 15, you could go there and you don't have to have read 1 through 14 to understand what I'm about to say to you in that chapter. And then also because people understand things visually and retain information more visually, I have illustrations that have like powerful summaries of what the point was in the chapter that are like thought provoking. Then I have like bullet points, summary boxes, you know, reflective questions, translation charts. You said this, we heard this, why don't you say this instead? Or Jim Crow versus Jim Crow 2.0, the reboot, explaining to you how it's the same thing. Or when somebody's like Black Lives Matter, January 6th, same thing. Nope, false equivalency, not the same thing. Then I have a chart that shows you how it is not the same thing, you know? And then some statistics. So anyway, the point is I'm taking really complex topics and trying to repackage it in a way that feels more accessible and digestible because, you know, the reality is most, especially white people, not everybody wants to take themselves on as a project, right? Yeah. And so I'm trying to give them information in a way that is, you know, that they may accept. So that's the rundown of the book. I'll just read you now before we dive in, like my favorite passage, and then we'll get into the movie. And so this is from my chapter where the rule is, it's not personal when people of color don't want to discuss race. And this is the illustration that goes with it. So it's like Sisyphus, you know, trapped in that perpetual hell. Right. So it
carrying
has like
the conversation of racism up the hill.
Exactly. And that we're basically tired of that. And so that's the illustration. And then I explain why we may not want to talk to, you know, talk about race. And then to drive the point home, I conclude the chapter with this analogy. And remember, Cameron and Jordan, the you in my writing is a white person. Okay. What it's like talking to you about race. Let's put this in perspective. Recall life living in the pandemic. Do you remember that haunting feeling you felt that never went away, that the virus was lurking at every corner? You couldn't escape it because there were reminders everywhere, on the news, online, in social media, and when you saw your neighbors or people on the street. You felt a sense of omnipresence as you walked around, always on high alert, looking at others, seeing if they wore masks, looked ill, or coughed. You noticed them. and observed how they reacted to you. You were in constant fear of your death. Loved ones may die or did die, and you felt perpetual anxiety. Your mental health was impacted along with your physical health from the stress. You had trouble sleeping. You weren't even safe in your own home because the virus could come to your door. You didn't know if you could trust the government or if officials had your best interests at heart, unsure if they would do something to kill you. You felt powerless, as if there were nothing you could do to change things to make your life better since you weren't in control. You had to resign yourself to your circumstance, but you didn't want to accept your reality. You wanted to resist and somehow make things better. When you tried, you didn't succeed. That's what it's like living under racism every day, 24/7, 365. Racism is a pervasive, invisible force, just like COVID. There's no escape. It's constant, never a break or reprieve. It's isolating and marginalizing. It attacks your life, bank account, livelihood, housing, healthcare, schools, and dinner table, and separates your family. You want the government to do something about it, but politicians want you to laissez-faire your way to non-solutions, absolving themselves of responsibility, willfully blind to its impact. You suck it up. You deal with the big picture systemic issues. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Heal yourself. Pave your destiny. Avoid your own death or murder. Welcome to living like a Black or Brown person in America. But with racism, there's no vaccine coming. No magic pill to inoculate society. This is what it's been like since the 1500s. It isn't getting better. There are new strains, new waves, and invisible resurgences, mutating, reinventing itself, seemingly dormant, but always there stalking, ready to strike and viciously kill. This is the reality. It's bleak. When you want to discuss racism, sometimes people of color only want to discuss it with those who understand what they've gone through. Not white folks who will trivialize things, which is akin to speaking to an anti-masker who berates innocent and defenseless store clerks. That's you questioning racism and their experiences. You're the anti-masker, anti-vaxxer in the conversation. When you come with covert microaggressions, overt aggression, a lack of knowledge, and a rejection of facts. Now, can you understand why no one wants to talk to you? They're already too busy trying to literally survive.
Well, I think all we could say to that is
message.
Because that's everything right there.
The thesis statement, right?
And very quickly, I guess, before we get to the movie again, like I think the thing that I really enjoy about the book is that it is firm, you know, and it's in the way that it approaches things, you know, which doesn't necessarily let people kind of say, like, I mean, you say it a lot of the times in the book, oh, that's not me. Like, oh, that, you know, that sounds terrible. Right. Like, I wish, you know, people who acted like that didn't do those things. And it's like, there's a whole reflective element of the book where it's like, do you do those things? Like, maybe think about it, take a second before you like push all that off onto somebody else. And I think that analogy is great, you know, in terms of using something that everybody can relate to, everybody experienced. We're all there, you know what I mean? It's not something that you're like, oh man, it must have been crazy to live through that time. Like, I can only imagine. It's like, it's very concrete. They got to move on. Right. They got to move on. And, you know, oftentimes, as we'll see maybe in this movie, you know, a lot of times white people kind of get to just experience the feel good moment, you know, and then, you know, because that's the that's kind of it. I forget the exact quote from American Fiction, but when his agent says, you know, like, white people don't like, they just want to feel assured, you know what I mean? They just want to feel
I collect quotes,
yeah,
and I know exactly, so keep going. I'm gonna look it up because I saved it in an app because I loved what he said.
But that's kind of it, you know. And even in a lot of these movies that we talk about, in the movie that we're about to talk about, like the quick solution, like instead of the work to be done to kind of get to the eventual place that we're trying to get to, it's like, where's the shortcut? You know, how can I make this go away very quickly? So I don't have to deal with it continuously. I can just kind of, we can end it. We can end apartheid. We can end racism. We can end these things, and then it's over. So now we can stop talking about it.
We can move on because we're all done.
Yes.
The quote from American Fiction is, white people think they want the truth, but they don't. They just want to feel absolved.
That part.
Right? So that's the quote, and that's exactly why that woman hugged Cameron.
Because that's the work.
Yes.
That's the work.
Because when she had the hug that she felt that she needed, right, because she probably was feeling very guilty as a white person.
And watching so the whole play, right?
Right. And so, I mean, I'm just theorizing here, but she potentially felt very guilty and that she needed some assurance that somehow she's not bad or that she's a good person or that she's somehow connecting with people of color or that she's supportive of people of color, you know, and that's where that comes from. It's that exceptionalism and the inability to look within and to really start to analyze and digest the behaviors and the choices that they engage in that harm people of color, right? And so they just want that absolution, right? Like even if you think about, you know, when we're looking at race relations now, or even South Africa with this film Invictus, right? Whether there's some like truth and reconciliation, right? People just want somehow for you to say, it is okay. We are okay. You know, or forgive me.
Mm-hmm. And it's not your fault. You didn't do it.
Yep.
Exactly. Exactly. As opposed to, and then therefore they think I can just go about my life. Everything is good. I don't have to work on myself. I don't have to do anything. Sure, I can continue to vote for that measure that's going to, you know, keep our schools segregated. That's going to disrupt DEI. You know, because now diversity, equity, inclusion is somehow supposed to be like the boogeyman of concepts, right? That, affirmative action or that reverse discrimination, as if that's a legitimate thing, or that we can't have any solutions to address systemic and institutional discrimination and racism, right? So that's the mindset.
Yeah. Cameron, I've told you many times, and I still feel like it's true. That woman's version of events, when she told that story, very different.
Very different.
Very different.
Dinner the next night was very exciting.
Is in her mind, you know what was playing in her mind? UNITY, right? Like that's what.
I was gonna say she was hearing the
Well, that's true too. It was UNITY at the same time, right?
Well, that's right. The movie that we are discussing today is 2009's Invictus. For those who aren't aware of this movie, big deal in 2009, it is directed by Clint Eastwood, stars Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela, also stars Matt Damon, and it's based on the book by John Carlo, which is called Playing the Enemy, Nelson Mandela and the Game That Made a Nation, and is about the 1995 Rugby World Cup, in which the Springboks, which is the national team for South Africa, went on to win the World Cup in Nelson Mandela's second year as president. And basically, like, as the movie will have you believe, united South Africa and everything was fine afterwards.
Racism as a whole ended in that
it
movie.
It was a wrap.
UNITY.
The movie had a budget about $50 million and was filmed entirely in South Africa. Box office was $122.2 million, so it made a lot of money.
It made it back.
Specifically, I mean, again, for a movie like this, which is usually kind of like that small drama, you know, like it is Clint Eastwood, this is why they keep giving him the money, because he makes the money. So, like, you know, if he can turn 50 into 100, I think, you know, he's always going to get the opportunity to do whatever he wants. But it went on to be nominated at the Academy Awards for Best Actor for Morgan Freeman, Best Supporting Actor for Matt Damon. Also nominated at the Golden Globes for Best Actor, Morgan Freeman, Supporting Actor Matt Damon, and Director Clint Eastwood. Even got some nods at the NAACP Image Awards. Outstanding Actor in a Motion Picture, Morgan Freeman won that one. And was also nominated for Outstanding Motion Picture and Writing. So, like, big movie, right?
I mean, all those nominations, all those nominations just like slipped right by me. I know that Morgan got nominated. I remember that, but Matt Damon getting nominated for this movie, that's the work. That's the stretch.
That is a stretch, because I do not feel that that was an Oscar worthy kind of performance. No. But then
he's,
you know,
done more with less.
Yes. Well, we'll get into it now because Cameron, you got the 5 minutes. This is, I will say this before you, because I texted this to you. This movie felt to me like the film equivalent of a book report. Like, so
just my gosh.
Rattling just, off
it's like absolutely no drama whatsoever. These things happened.
Yes. And then it was over. So do your best, but whenever you're ready, go ahead and take us through Invictus.
Yes, sure. Okay. All right. So the film starts on an exact date, actually. It starts on February 11th, 1990. This is the day that Nelson Mandela is freed from prison after 27 years. He is the first democratically elected president of South Africa, succeeding de Klerk.
Yeah.
Yes. So as we're all familiar, there is apartheid going on at this time. Whites and blacks are segregated in an African nation, which is a wild concept, correct? So as the story is told, we get one scene where Nelson Mandela, as you know, president, he leaves his mansion during the day. He gets up, he leaves his mansion to take a run. And in this first scene, we're treated as if there are, you know, specters of assassination about. You know, he's taking his run in his neighborhood, and a van is slowly approaching, following around the corner, and it's just announcing his presidency. It is literally a newspaper boy dropping off a satchel of newspapers saying that he's been elected. That's all. But the specter of unrest is in the air, basically. So his first couple days as president, you know, things are a little tough, but we're starting to notice that he's not really, it doesn't seem like he's concerned, Nelson Mandela, the character in this movie, is concerned with like the politics of the day. It seems that he's actually more concerned with trying to unite the nation. He starts talking to his aides. His aides are like, well, you should start talking about housing. You should start talking about, you know, our resources and things. And he's thinking about rugby. He attends a game. He attends a game between the Springboks, which are the rugby team of South Africa and England. And they're not doing so well. The Springboks, we're catching them in the middle of just a terrible, terrible run. And also at this time, the sports committee for South Africa is meeting. And now this is a different sports committee than before, because now these black people are free to vote. Black people are free to, you know, hold Congress amongst themselves. So the native sports council is having a meeting to change their the team's colors from the traditional green and gold to, you know, the more colorful flag that we're all familiar with today, with the red, the black, the blue, all the colors in the symbol of the nation.
Yeah, and it's important to note, because they don't make it super clear, but like Springboks were like a symbol of racism and oppression amongst black
pretty
people
much
in South Africa. And so it's like, this is like tearing down, you know, Civil War Confederate statues, you know, in their mind. Like, this is like,
pretty,
get that out of here. We don't want to see that.
Exactly. Exactly. And they vote on it, and unanimously they vote to change the uniforms. And at that moment, Nelson Mandela, you know, decides to divert from his regular routine to go directly to the sports council and hold court and ask them, I ask you to turn over your vote. And the people are like, why are we turn? This is exactly what we fought for. And he says, to really truly win over the nation, we don't have to change the colors, but we do have to change the perception of us. And, you know, an interesting concept. And they rehold the vote. Turns out it didn't go, of course, because the people wanted what they want. He got 12 votes instead of the room. So he decides to go straight to the team. He goes straight to the team. And there we meet the team captain, Francois Pienaar. Forgive me, by the way, for all the incorrect Afrikaans pronunciations as I go through this entire podcast today. All right. But this is the character played by Matt Damon. He's the captain of the South African rugby team. Again, they're not doing so well, but he decides to go straight to them. Nelson Mandela does his research and goes to them and says, hey, to unite the people of this country, the people of the world, the people who of the world who you're dealing with, you know, on a geopolitical scale, want to recognize us as a nation that is coming together. And in order to do this, I'm going to need you to win. Basically, just win games. Stop sucking, is what Nelson yes. came in and said. And Madiba was like, I got out of prison. I'm sick of the crap, guys.
And the World Cup is being held in South Africa for the first time. In
South Africa.
And so they've already qualified. But, you know, he's concerned because they are kind of sucky. And, like, yeah, it would help a lot if you could maybe just, I don't know, win the World Cup one time.
Well, they qualified because they were the host nation.
Right. Yes. So it wasn't even on ability. It was just like, oh, you're hosting. So I guess
we'll let you play, dog. We'll let you play, dog. And also,
I'll just add one more interesting little wrinkle, which is, I, you know, not having researched this deeply, but this is also kind of important too, because coming out of apartheid, it's like South Africa is finally allowed to compete in some international sports. So to be hosting the Rugby World Cup is a big deal, because they were barred from, you know, with the boycott and sanctions and everything against the apartheid regime. Couldn't necessarily compete in sports. I don't know if they were competing in rugby specifically, but generally they were excluded from many, many international competitions and events.
And also at this time, in the movie, we're starting to see that places in within South Africa's government, obviously we're meeting the president, are starting to integrate. So namely his security team. His security team used to be of his tribe, and they would call him Madiba. And when the white Afrikaners were hired, there are white Afrikaners who are hired to be part of his security team. There's an instant rift. They don't call him the same name. They don't speak the same language. They don't have the same customs. But we're starting to see that as time goes on and as the team starts winning games, they start to get closer. The customs start to mesh and they start to help each other just as a security team, simply. So basically what we are treated to over the course of the movie is training montages, several scenes of this team visiting various downtrodden places in South Africa, including a township, which is part of Mandela's, campaign, One Nation, One Love, to unite the people. Mandela is starting to understand the optics of the situation, that if he has this team go to certain townships and play with the children and educate them about rugby and, like, bring the sport to the nation, then he can probably win favor that way. And which it starts to work. And on top of it, the team starts to win. And the team wins right up into their rivals, the Australian team. They manage to even defeat the Australian team. And then they get to, I'd be remiss to forget this scene, but there is also a scene where they go to his old prison and see the cell that he was in for 20 years. And it's with these scenes that we start to see that the team is understanding the power of racism and the power of subjugation in the country that they, you know, define as a team.
And it's also important to know, so there's one black person on the team, Chester.
Oh yes,
the rest of the team is
my guy Chester.
So it's an all-white team besides just one black guy who gets hurt for a game, and they don't miss a beat, and then he comes back, and it's also fine.
He comes right back.
And I'll say one other thing is when they're visiting Robben Island, which is where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for decades and the other political prisoners, that's when there's, like, Matt Damon is in the cell and sort of stretches his arms
to see the length of the cell. Sort of,
like, Morgan Freeman, you know, Mandela is reciting the Invictus poem, which is like the thread, you know, between, like, it's the inspiration that, you know, for the film, and it's a poem that Mandela gives to Francois, and it's supposed to be like what got him through the tough times. And then he like writes down the poem later in the film and gives it to him. And if you want me to read also, it at some point, I printed it out if you want that.
Nice. We can get there. We can definitely get there. Also, Invictus in Latin, meaning undefeated. And so we get to the point where they meet their final rivals, the New Zealand team, the All Blacks, as they're called, because their uniforms are all black. They even do their traditional haka dance in front of them at the start of the game as a form of intimidation. But guess what? It doesn't work. Not in this movie. No. And also on top of it, a historical event that it did actually happen. Yes. The case of a 747 flying down over the stadium with the words "Good luck, Baka" written under it. Baka being the team, the South African team, and they took that gold. They took that good luck all the way through the end of the game. They managed to win that game in extra time, 15-12. They win the game. Mandela manages to. He is the one to give the cup to Francois's character. Francois holds it up. We get a shot of black hands touching white hands, touching the trophy. There's also a shot, this crazy couple of shots between the game of a little African, South African boy who's just picking up glass, I'm sure, to recycle near a cop car. And the cops are like, hey, what are you doing there? But they're not really paying attention because they're listening to the game. And then over the course of like three shots, they're like, oh, hey, let this little boy listen to the game with us. Oh, we bought him a Coke. Oh, we're lifting him over our heads in triumph. And we put a little cop hat on it too, because don't they love the cops?
All brown people just love white police officers.
Yes.
We love it when white police officers put their hats on our heads and mm-hmm. and cheer with
to
us.
To go with the boot that they also put on our neck.
There you go. And so pretty much that's how the movie ends. We cheer. Little African boys are lifted above cops' heads everywhere. And we hear Morgan Freeman's Mandela voice chanting "Invictus" over and over again, the poem, and chanting the word, and the movie's over. Thankfully.
And I'll add one other thing: when Mandela hands Francois the trophy or the cup, right? He says to Francois, and he thanks him for what he did for the country.
Yes, he does.
Because, because that's how why saviors roll.
Well, of course, now we have to play. Let's talk about Invictus, because I'm coming in with a hot take off top. All right.
Go for it.
And my hot take is a movie we've covered before, The Color of Friendship, a Disney Channel original movie, is a more astute and pointed critique of apartheid than Invictus, which is crazy. It's just
flame insane. Him. Flame him. Flame Clint. Flame him.
I haven't even seen nor heard of that one.
The Color of Friendship.
It's a classic.
It's a Disney Channel movie from the 90s, which is basically about this white South African child who comes over at a student exchange program to live with. And it's a true story too. So it's another one of those that's kind of like this happened. So
but you said a white South African. You mean like Elon Musk?
Maybe. Kind of.
Who my nickname for him, by the way, is Apartheid Clyde. Okay, so
now in deep conversations with one ex-president, maybe trying to pay off some of his legal bills. But this girl comes over and is living with this black family. Because this little girl was like, I really want, to have a South African come over and live with us because apartheid's so unjust. And I want to give, them an opportunity to experience life outside of that. And of course, instead they get a white child. And so this whole situation about, them both learning cultural lessons and seeing that racism is on the little white South African child learns that racism is terrible and apartheid is terrible, and like she's been brainwashed by her parents, and like I think Steve Ditko, does he get killed during the course of the
during
movie?
Oh, Stephen Bantu Biko gets killed during the time frame?
Yeah, and then
in
like
a
she
Disney
goes,
movie.
She goes
somehow
back to South Africa and is telling the story about birds nesting and like people living. It's a Disney movie. They say nigger, but it's a Disney movie. And so it's like an old Disney movie. It's like an original Disney movie. But that movie at least is investigating apartheid. It's talking about what's happening. It's having a conversation for kids. It's a children's movie, so it's discussing it through that framework. But this movie would have you believe a number of things. First and foremost, there's no explanation of anything, right? So like it's taking the assumption that you either A, know everything about Nelson Mandela and apartheid, or B, hoping that you don't know anything about it and it can just kind of like fill in the blanks and like you won't ask any questions.
It's pretty flat. It's pretty flat from providing historical context, which watching the film 15 years after it was made, it really does not provide nearly enough context for any person that would decide to watch that movie now that did not live through or have any experience or recollection of what was happening in South Africa.
Because
I would also dare to
say, Mandela like is very concerned about rugby, right? Like to the point where he leaves several meetings with world leaders to check on the game and score. And it's
and maybe he did that in real life, who knows, but I don't think it's the best image to put forth.
But well, it's done in such a way that you like outside of the scene where he collapses because he's working so hard, like you would get the sense that he's not doing anything else. You know what I mean? Like
true.
He's just working. He's like assistant
multiple
coach.
Times multiple times he tells his aides we should get some work done while we watch these games. We got to watch these games now. I understand that we got like, you know, a food crisis or a housing crisis or whatever it may be. But is the game on? Can we get the game on in here?
I mean, the guess, you know, the other thing too is like the course reason why I assume that the producers, the scriptwriter, you know, thought that this was okay is because what they're trying to convey to the viewer is that this was a symbol for something bigger than just a game, right? This was what was going to unify the country, which is what is problematic with all of these films, right? Like the whole white savior trope. And because at the end of the day, what they're trying to show is that you can solve racism on an individual basis and not a systemic basis.
Yes.
That you can have an encounter with someone and then everything is like, you know, because at the end, we're supposed to like feel great, right? Like the maid that they know absolutely nothing about, who they invite to go to the World Cup game. You know, and then when she sings the you know, national anthem, I don't even remember the words, but, you know, and then the Matt Damon's mother's character looks over and surprised, like, oh, you know the song? And when that happened, I thought, and you probably don't know if she even has any children, and she's probably been working in your house for decades, right? Like, you know what I mean? There are so many problems. But I will say, one of the reasons why I picked this film was because I also wanted to have a film, even if though it was supposed to be taking place in a different country, but a country where I had some connection to, right? So like when I was at Columbia Law School, I did a summer internship at the South African Human Rights Commission and worked in and lived in Cape Town for 3 months, which is where Robben Island is, right? And I went and visited that when Mandela was you know, toured the United States before he became president and was freed from prison. I remember seeing him go speak at the Oakland Coliseum because I grew up in the Bay Area, right? So I tried to pick things where or pick something where I, you know, had sort of like lived through and had experienced it. And I'll say one thing that came to mind too about the whole Springbok, and should the Springbok, and for anyone who doesn't know what a Springbok is, basically like another form of Bambi, but you know, as their mascot. But the whole thing about whether they were going to change the name of the team or change the colors of the team or somehow re-envision mm-hmm. a team, what played through my mind was at the time, you know, when you have these countries that have like, they're freeing themselves, they're especially in Southern Africa, liberating themselves from white colonization and oppression, like in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia.
Right.
In Zimbabwe, like they did not have the same response as South Africa with their Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Zimbabwe was like, we're about to seize the land of the white farmers and give it back to the black people. You right. know, which created a whole huge international thing, right, with pressure from overseas. And so to me, the backdrop of like, do they get to keep the Springboks as the Springboks? Is this, you get to oppress us and you get to keep all your shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, to briefly go back to the scene with the housekeeper, I also sure. loved previously, they come in, they get four tickets. They look at around, they say, 1, 2, 3, 4? Who else would go? And then the camera wild. Pans it's... to her and she's just like.
Right. And don't forget that in the film, when Francois go gets to meet Nelson Mandela and he's going to, I guess, you know, the capital, the presidential palace, wherever, you know, wherever he's going,
mm-hmm.
Their maid says to them, you know, please mention, and I don't know if she said something about maybe the buses or I don't yeah. remember what, but she asked him to do something. He never mentioned it.
Never
I
did.
Thought, was it going to come up in a subsequent conversation? It yeah. never came up. So it's like, she needs a better busing system so that she can come and slave away for you. And you yeah. didn't even yeah. mention, you know, this was her shot yeah. at like an improvement right. to her life.
Now, I don't even know if that really happened or not, but I was
I'm just talking about the
screenwriter.
Who knows?
No,
who knows?
No, but definitely, I mean, I'm thinking the screenwriter is at least going to have some cutesy thing like Matt Damon turns around when he's at the door to be like, oh, hey, by the way, maybe we should change the bus routes in, you know, the town I live in, you know, for my maid who works right. really hard. You know, that would have been great. But I clocked that too. I was like, you know what? Let me pay attention in this next scene because I
right?
know
like,
he ain't going to say nothing.
He didn't say a damn thing. Not a nothing. Damn thing. The only thing that was supposed to be beneficial was that they let her go to the world championship rugby match. And then through that experience, racism was solved.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Because they like excitement together and celebrate together.
And,
right?
and they shared Cokes together.
Connection.
Yeah. I wrote some of them down. You've got the, you know, you've got the right, the people at the bar or wherever, like everyone is celebrating the people, the white mm-hmm. person hugging the black person. Even the security details seem like they're, you know, vibing over yeah. the game. I mean,
oh yeah, they like chummily like shrug shoulders.
I'll say, you know, a couple of right. And there are a lot of moments where you could have upchucked, but I mean, there are just so many fake things. And I'll say this. Because I, you know, when I watched the film, I took some notes and some things that, you know, I found very problematic, right? So you talked about before when you're giving the breakdown, Cameron, how at the beginning of the film, right, when there's the security detail and there are the black South Africans that are his security detail and then the Afrikaners that are the detail and they're not going to be like fired, right? And then what I find very curious about these films is they always have to do some reverse discrimination prejudice undertone, mm-hmm. right? So it's right. So instead of it just being like, I mean, of course you're going to question the Afrikaners. Like, can they even protect the Madiba, right? Like when he was imprisoned, like whether or not, just not even like necessarily a race issue. It's like you have systematically imprisoned this man. Are you going to do what's necessary, which is, would you take a bullet for this man?
Yep.
Right?
Right.
Like, which is a fair
But they present
question.
It as a question. They present right. it as a question rather
right.
than like,
But instead, you, it's like...
As an accusation, sorry.
Right. But instead, it's the instant, like, discrimination by the black security, head of security against, you know, the frankly very Aryan looking security detail, you know, that come in. And so therefore, as you're going through this, experiencing various white savior tropes throughout the film, you're also experiencing these moments of like reverse discrimination and planting the seed. It goes
both ways, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like planting the seed of that. And so where you see the prejudice is on the side of the Black people, right? Because mm-hmm. they don't have a ton of instances other than like these, oh, I don't want to sing the national anthem and learn how to sing that song. Or the comment of the father, like, I just don't like Nelson Mandela, but doesn't follow it up with the statement about it, right? Yeah. Instead, where you see and experience the discrimination and the quote unquote racism mm-hmm. is from the Black people.
Another small, subtle scene that I picked up on, but I'm sure white people watching the movie might miss. There's, I don't know if it was Matt Damon's mother specifically, but there's a scene where a white woman is handing out Springbok jerseys to children. And, you know, she's like, oh, free jerseys, take one, take one. And this little Black kid is like, I don't want that, and walks away. And she's like, that was rude. Why wouldn't he? And the Black, you know, teacher that is there is like, they'd beat his ass if he put that on. Like, that is, he can't wear that. Because that's like an oppressive symbol. Like, we don't do that.
Right.
And she's kind of like, huh.
I didn't right. And that's the only way that they drop into the film what the Springboks actually represented.
Yes.
Which was the apartheid regime and the oppression of Black Africans taking their country, their land, their resources, and de facto enslaving them.
And they mentioned,
which is interesting.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, because it's interesting that that scene comes way after the initial scene with the sports council, because in the scene with the sports council, it is not like laid out that this is why they're voting on these things. They're voting on it because of what we already understand to be the context.
Right.
But it's not laid out in layman's terms. And I'm not saying that this movie has to be all things at once, but it definitely has to be informative when serious decisions are being made.
Yes.
And I think that it feels kind of on purpose. It feels a little on purpose that's left out there, but not clarified until later.
I mean, there's a lot of fluff to it. I mean, which, in all honesty, like, what do you really expect from Clint Eastwood anyway?
Yeah.
Right? Like,
we can get into that.
At a Republican convention talking to the chair with nobody in it. And he's made other problematic films, right? Gran Torino, if that's savior, if ever I saw one. But it's like white savior while I say racist. Show. Right. While he says racist things to the Asians in the film, while he's also saving them.
Yes.
Oh, well, yeah.
I think I wanted to tie some of the conversation back into your book, because there's a bedrock race rule that you have, which is basically to disrupt racism every day. And there's three steps, the first of which is learn to unlearn. But it is interesting, because I would give a little bit of a caveat in that you can learn to unlearn, but sometimes you're purposefully not even taught certain things, you know, to kind of obscure what information and knowledge you might have. And I think part of that is happening here, where, like, if you don't know anything about apartheid and you don't know anything about the reason why, like, Nelson Mandela is released from jail. Why was he in prison? Nelson Mandela.
They just drop in. Oh, this is where he was for 30 years. Like, that's it's not crazy. You know, being held over waiting for, you know, your bond hearing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For like over the weekend. You know what I mean? Like, that's 30 years.
That's 30 years.
Like at a quarry, however you say the word, like chipping away at stones.
Yes. Well, and there's
I love that he put the shot in the movie of Matt Damon looking at the rocks, and then the image
of Ghost Mandela,
like, right, chipping away at the rock materializes. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? It's so corny.
There's a lot of cheeseball activity happening in this.
But there's also, like, Nelson Mandela, if the movie would have you believe it, like, people kind of didn't like him. But then they did, you know, because they won the World Cup, and everybody
that came Nelson around Mandela, on him because of rugby.
Nelson Mandela, similar to Martin Luther King Jr., is somebody that white people love now. At the time,
yeah,
He was a terrorist. They hated him.
Right, right. And, and you know, I get so tired of people like with Martin Luther King that want to go into like the colorblind ideology. Like, mm-hmm. no, it's about the content of your character, not your skin. Like, first of all, he was talking about a goal, right? Like a destination of where we can get in right. the future and not the present. Yes. But instead, people want to hijack that. And then use that to say, we shouldn't have reparations. We shouldn't have affirmative actions. Like Martin Luther King was shot when he started talking about economic justice, right? When he economic was starting to
stability
speak
for Black people, exactly.
Right, right. And if you think about the March on Washington, it wasn't just the March on Washington. It was a March on Washington for jobs and freedom, mm-hmm. okay?
Boom,
and
there you
so,
go.
You know, and so he was all for having... being color aware, right? Because you can't right. solve anything if you're not conscious about what is actually happening. But getting back to your point, Jordan, about the bedrock race rule and people needing to educate themselves, I mean, it's true, right? Like that rule that I created, trying to help somebody get to a better decision is, you know, the first step before you're trying to decide, like, should I do this? Should I not do this? You know, because it's a rule to help somebody deal with any sort of race issue, right? Because the rules in the book, they're all topic specific, but then there's like the bedrock race rule. But the first thing that has to happen, which is this universal rule, is you need to learn something,
mm-hmm.
right? You need to like learn to unlearn, right? Like you need to engage in some external education
and if
to understand and to give yourself some context, especially in this country where we don't want to teach real history. We're trying to blow up you know, we're trying to ban books, right? We're like, it's starting to feel very McCarthy-like, very book burning, very Fahrenheit 451, and control the information. And so, you know, when things happen, people are like, oh, I had no idea that that happened, you know, because there's so much hidden history.
And I would say, though, one of the facts that we love here on the show is during 2020, white people are like, oh, man, I don't know what to do. What should I do? I need to watch something. The Help. I'll watch The
right.
Help.
Right.
Most screen movie on Netflix in 2020.
That was so weird. That was so weird.
And you know what? That film has more than one trope, right? Yeah. So it's got the white savior trope plus the magical Negro.
Yep.
Right? Wow. Because then you have all of these Black maids that are helping a whole bunch of white characters.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the woman who's like the journalist writing the book, right? She's got her magical Negroes helping her through her journey of self-actualization. And then you have the Jessica Chastain character, right? Who also has the magical Negro in the Octavia Spencer, right? So they're
Octavia
just
Spencer.
Yes. There are a bunch of things happening all at one time. I will say this other thing, if you guys ever decide to like think of other, you know, things to consider aside from, I mean, you're not going to change like the white savior trope.
Yeah.
But when my publicist like mentioned it to me that with the films, one thing that came to mind was white people in foreign peril.
Oh,
you know, like
Yeah, we've got action movie versions of that. We've got courtroom drama versions of that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, like Blood Diamonds is that, you know?
What was the one with Owen Wilson went to Vietnam with his family and got caught in a coup?
Yeah.
There's always one of those, even in some ways, maybe, you know, Black Hawk Down, potentially, or the Sandra Bullock film that came out last year or the year before that has who's the the strip movie guy?
Oh, Channing Tatum.
Yes, exactly. You know, Magic Mike, right? Yeah, the Magic Mike guy. Yeah, so Channing Tatum, right? And like she's over, like she goes to some Latin American country, I presume, or something, right? And she's in foreign mm-hmm. peril. But sorry, I digress. I got us off topic.
Yeah. Well,
but this is what it is. This is what it is. It's literally like an amalgamation of all these different tropes to sideline guilt, to assuage guilt, you know?
And I'll say this other thing. I struggle in trying to find a movie with Black people in it that I want to watch and won't feel bad about, you know, like, so if I go and try to figure out like every day, like I am so like, because I'm consciously aware of the messages that are being conveyed all of the time through
For sure.
media. And so the things that irritate me are the white savior trope, the magical Negro, the colorism issue, right? So you can never have a dark-skinned Black woman that is opposite a Black man, right? So it's always going to be Black man, white woman, Black man, light woman, Black man, some other person of color, woman, but not darker than him. So then it is like erasure of and making darker skinned women feel that they're not beautiful. And then you also have just all of these stereotypes, right? Like, I don't want to see a film with another basketball player that makes it good. Somebody who gets out of the hood, someone who, you know, rises up from adversity with the single mom that was on crack that had some other guy. Like, can I just see a film with just regular people going about their life and they don't have to have overcome anything except the daily adversity that happens in every quotidian experience?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I mean, tying two of those thoughts together, the white person in foreign peril, like, we did a movie, Serpent and the Rainbow, which is takes place in Haiti during, you know, like
during
the coup.
Revolution.
And that movie doesn't mention it until like the literal end, right?
It's this actually movie, in the final sequence.
Yeah.
They don't mention what? That they're in Haiti?
Well, that, they don't that mention there's a political the revolution happening.
Oh, the revolution, right. Because, you know, things happen.
But it happens during the final sequence of the movie, and the characters just happen to be caught up in it.
This is a movie is where there's heavy political unrest happening. You wouldn't know. Everybody's just focused on rugby. You know what I mean? Like, Nelson Mandela, like, again, there's multiple times where they tried to invoke the idea that he might be assassinated, but really the worst thing that ever happens to him is somebody, I think, throws beer one time.
I don't remember the beer. No, you know what?
The bucket of, or the beer with the ice in it.
Yeah.
At the first game.
When he goes to shake hands in the crowd.
See, but of course, because he sees everything. Yeah.
You know, one thing that happened in the film that I was like, oh, see, that's really on point. So in the film, when they're at the World Cup game, the final match, and Nelson Mandela is up in the box, with whom I presume is the Prime Minister of New Zealand, right? Or president, I presume. Is it prime minister? I don't remember their system. Probably prime minister. And so they're sitting there, and Nelson Mandela says, oh, do you want to, like, wager a bet? And so the prime minister, you know, the New Zealand guy says, how about all of your gold for our sheep? And when he said that, you know, and then Mandela said, I was thinking more of a case of wine. And when he said that, I said, and that is exactly how they do it.
Yep.
They want of your resources for some trifling ass shit.
But it's crazy. And it, you know what, to bring it back to the Clint Eastwood of it all, I almost forgot that there was as much like going on in the country outside of like the first scene with the, you know, the idea of assassination kind of being like projected there. But throughout the movie, we know, I mean, if you do know your history, yes, that the country is in like full unrest. There's, I mean, you thought racism was crazy here. I mean, during the 90s, I mean, it was, but over there, it was 10 times worse. I mean,
because I live there after this match, right? After the World Cup, right? Because the World Cup was in 95, right?
Yeah, 95.
So I live there after, based on this film, everything was solved, right? They had their reconciliation. We're group hugging. We're sharing sodas with the, you know, borderline itinerant child, right? Like, we're everything is hunky dory, right? I saw and witnessed and experienced so many ridiculously, overtly racist things while I was living in South Africa, including while I was at the South African Human Rights Commission. right? So like the I people mean, that are supposed to be working on these things, you know. And then my housemate, who was also a Columbia Law student, she was working at the equivalent of like legal aid or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just mm-hmm. the, you know, the two of us together, it was like, we were continually talking about the ridiculous things, like, you know, people saying things to us, and in part, maybe because we're, you know, it could go either way, because we're foreign. So therefore, people felt comfortable opening up to us, or because, you know, and so therefore, you know, we're different. And then maybe saying things to me because, again, I'm light skinned, but I would still be a person of color by South African definition. You know, I'd be definitely. Color, right? And then my housemate is brown skinned, but they, you know, saying things like, well, you know, I mean, the black, they're just so lazy. You know, like these kinds of comments. And when someone would say those kinds of things to me, it just made me think of, yeah, just like in the United States, black people weren't lazy until they wanted to be properly paid mm-hmm. for their labor. As soon as we get rid of slavery, oh, now we're supposedly lazy. And now have all these black people who want some equality, oh, they're lazy. Okay, I see what you're doing.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is, I feel like the movie seems to not portray any of that actuality. Like you said, you went through like daily occurrences. Stuff at the Human Rights Organization, let alone just like walking, you know, to work or what it, you know.
Or I also went to prisons, right? So like one of the tasks that I had to do was I went to the prison in Cape Town. And mm-hmm. I had to do this research report on people awaiting bail, right? And the South African Constitution was also saying that, you know, people should have a right to a speedy trial, just like, you know, we say here, but very similar things, like how we have people sitting in New York in Rikers for years because maybe they can't afford their bail, awaiting a trial as their life goes to shit, right? And so, I walked in the prison. I saw the cells, right? I had meetings with large groups of prisoners talking about their experiences, and the things that they're recounting to me are all just endemic of structural racism and people that shouldn't be there, but they're there, you know, awaiting their speedy trial, years and years in the waiting.
But this movie treats it like it's a simple trifle, like it's a simple, it could be, you know, it could have happened or it could not have happened, might have been in the past, honestly, but right now the country seems to be healing, whereas it was honestly the poster child of modern racism.
Right. The country is healing, and it's the black people who are engaging in racism against the white people.
Well, that's one of the things I found so fascinating about this movie, is like there's a complete absence of drama, you know, in the sense of like Nelson Mandela wants to do something, he does it. Will they win this match? They do. You know what I mean? Like as soon as a question is asked, it is answered, and we just move on to the next thing. But
let alone if you know history, like if you know history, then you already know what's going to happen. But you're watching the movie, and the movie is just telling you the same thing.
Right. But besides Nelson Mandela, there is a complete lack of black perspective in the film. We barely, if ever, get any black people. We get the scene with the sports council, right? And because we are not given any context or history, right? Like they seem angry. Right. And so Nelson Mandela is the voice of reason who comes in and says, you know, my brothers, my sisters, like we need to really, I mean, they posit it in a way like Nelson Mandela. This was tactical. This was a savvy political move. Like, obviously, he was doing this for reasons. But, you know, he also understood that there was a lot. He was playing a big hand here, that maybe, you know, this doesn't work the way that I want it to, specifically because the black people in South Africa, it's not necessarily, this is what white people get confused about all the time. And this is what they're so scared about. We talk about this all the time, Cameron. They think we want revenge. They think that, oh my God, black people, like all they want to do is do exactly what we've done to them right back to us. And like,
that's the second why they're afraid.
Right. The second we give them any power, or like they're able to take any power, like the boot's going to be on us now. And it's like, black people,
they're
just want to
come for us.
We just want exactly. to live. We just don't want to have to worry about any of this stuff anymore. And so like the movie presents it as, oh, like, yeah, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to take away their rugby team, and then they're going to take away their money, and then they're going to, you know, Nelson Mandela's like, hey, wait a minute, guys, come on, like, let's not get so crazy here. But really what's happening is Nelson Mandela is like, all right, look, we are going to take some things away. And because we're going to take some things away, we need to almost pacify them in a sense of like, if we allow them this symbol here, you know, to kind of be symbolic of maybe not necessarily the old regime, but like something that they value, because in real life, you know, like the person who wrote the book that this movie is based on was doing reporting in South Africa, apartheid times, but also post-apartheid times. And like one of the things that he found out when he was talking to people specifically at that 1994 election was like white Afrikaners were basically ready to give it up because they love sports and they love rugby. And so they were like, look, if this gets us back into international competition, whatever, you know what I mean? Like we've had it. We've been kind of banned from all of this space for all this time. We just want to play rugby again, right? Like we just want to have that back. And so Mandela was like, okay, you know, I've pinpointed something that it's a gesture. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't cost us anything. You know, we can just kind of.
When you're talking, two quotes went through my mind. You know, one is from Zora Neale Hurston, where she says, if you're silent about your pain, they will kill you and say you enjoyed it. You know, and it made me think about that. Like, you know, yes, they want us to be silent, right? Which is a continuation of the oppression. Like they want to silence you. They don't want you to acknowledge what happened to you, because having to acknowledge it means that something may need to be done about it. Mm-hmm. So that was one quote that went through my head while you were talking. And the other one was from Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's either Ta-Nehisi Coates or Elie Mystal, you know, who says something like, you know, Black people don't care about race. We care about justice, right? Like in terms of, it made me think of that, like in terms of like, and that justice doesn't have to be that we're, you know, we're not going to enslave you too, like you enslaved us. But that is like the core of the fear, is that because deep down, they know that they have done terrible things, past and present, right? So the people who just want to say, let's, you know, can't we just move on? Why do we have to deal with the past? You know, part of that is, well, let's not deal with the past, so that creates an environment such that I can do this to you again.
Right. But that's part of this movie's problem, because this movie really doesn't acknowledge the past. It displays Mandela's move as like a move of like being a savvy politician, but not as endemic of like the actual issue. Obviously, like there's images. The first image in the film is a group of white Afrikaners playing rugby on one field, and the field is very nice and manicured and part of a larger like sports complex. And then literally on the opposite side of the road is, you know, Black South Africans playing on a dingy field, no net in the goal and everything like that. And Mandela's motorcade goes up the road between them, and the Black South Africans cheer for them. And, you know, that's obviously an image.
And then the white ones are like scowling
And the white ones scowl in confusion. Right. And that's an easy image. We all understand that. Right. Black people, you know, this is a champion of the people. The white Afrikaners were confused and saddened that, you know, a reign had ended pretty much. But they don't really investigate anything about the situation that got them there, which is obviously it's difficult. You can't like, you know, just display the entire like history of racism and segregation in South Africa before we get to the main plot of the film. But this movie honestly paints racism as like, that was the problem, that we were living on two different sides of the road,
and they still in 2024 live on two different sides of the road. You know, another, and I'll just say another thing that a total side comment, but getting back to something I said earlier, another one of the reasons why I did pick the film was because I actually played rugby in college. So I was I'll
Can
pick,
you tell us, because watching this movie,
you didn't understand the scrums, did you?
Well, it's not even that, because it's like, certainly not being familiar with rugby, like you're kind of watching it and you're like, okay, I think I know what's happening. They do that like demonstration with the kids
the
to kind
tutorial,
of give
short
you
tutorial.
Like a bit of how it works.
A quick one.
But because I don't know if it's just like the way that Eastwood decided to film it, or if he was hewing so close to literal, like, because you'll watch, like, somebody put up on YouTube like a side by side of like literal actual footage from the World Cup and like other events and like this movie, and he hewed very close to like how the game looked. But because you're not watching it like it's presented on television, you're watching it like you're right there with the players.
It's cinematic.
Like it's not the same situation. And so you're watching things happen and you're kind of like, I guess, but like, are there quarters to rugby? Like, can you?
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
what
it
are...
depends. Yeah, I mean, there are many things that are like, they're sort of like parallel similarities with rugby and American football and soccer.
Right.
You know, but one of the main things is with rugby is like what they said, you can't throw the ball forward. And it's also like this game of, and there's like no padding, no head stuff, right? And
yeah,
which means you can only hit people, but so hard. But some of it is like brute force. So like when you see them in what's called a scrum, and it's just sort of like the force, like the ball is on the ground and it's sort of like whoever has more force, it's like the ball is going to come out on their side.
Oh.
And then they get to have the ball because they won that tussle with, you know, and then, you know, and then they can try to score, which is called a try. So it's like, you know, you can score just like in football, but the points are different. And then they have like the, you know, like the field goal conversion thing, you know. And so,
yeah,
there are definitely some similarities. But if you're not familiar, you're like, why the hell are they always huddled together like this?
Well, and it was also
or
like,
when they throw in the ball and they're like holding the person up. That's just, it's just how the game is, you know, the game is played.
Well, because I think because in a typical sports movie, like there's that, oh, like, you know, somebody got injured and like, how are we going to overcome this problem? Or like, oh, you know, there's 10 seconds left and we have to go on this dramatic drive to do. And like, they just won. They just won all the
games.
I'd say it's more.
They let the clock run out towards the end because the clock is still going. Yeah.
I'd say it's more of the second thing that you said, Jordan, where in like, you could say like an American football movie where we usually like, you know, take it by the quarter or by the half. And, you know, at the half, this team was there and this team was that, or it was a tie or such and such, whatever. And this movie kind of, it's like the game is just a fluid. All the games are just kind of like fluid until the final play. And then I'm supposed to assume one team won and the other lost, and however
well,
it shook out was however it shook
and,
out.
But you know they won because they jumped up and down and hugged all the black people.
I just assumed like they were gonna win, but I was like, you're assuming drama is happening, but I'm just kind of watching it like
there was very little drama. You know what? That is like one of the biggest criticisms of this film, not just the lack of history and context, but the flatness of it, right? Like
the sports scenes play out just like the conversation scenes. It's all kind of one mood throughout,
linear.
Just like, and that's why it got confusing during the games, because
they didn't even, have like a peak valley with Chester getting injured, right?
He
like,
just was injured.
Right.
It he just was injured. He didn't show up to the moment where like Mandela shows up and shows that he studied and learned a lot of their names, and they give him a hat, you know, a baseball cap, like, ooh, we're unifying over the hat.
The way, the scene where he congratulates the entire team, we watch him congratulate the entire team.
Yeah.
Oh,
he
my
stops
God.
Saying names like, after a while, he's just like, hey, good luck, man.
Good luck. Yeah. He got to like the first 10 guys, and then the other 10 guys were like,
I kind of do it. I was waiting for the Key and Peele Obama where like he gets to Chester and he's like, hey,
dabs him up. Like,
all right. It is kind of like, Chester, hey, we're all depending on you.
There could have been so much more development of Chester as a character, you know, like based on reality. Like, what is it like to be the only Black person on a team of Afrikaners?
Well, doesn't he say his, like, one of his first big lines is, well, what do you think about this? He's like, I don't think it interferes with my rugby.
Yeah.
And that's his perspective. That's the missed opportunity right there.
In reality, though, a lot of Afrikaners anti-Chester, you know what I mean? And like, he faced a lot of racism just to because the thing that this movie does, right, is sports can be an opiate for sure, right? Like, if you've ever lived in a city where you've won a championship, a Super Bowl, a NBA championship, whatever, the parade happens, everybody's out in the streets, it's crazy. There's, you know, just this overwhelming feeling of like unity and like we did it. And then the next day, and then the day after that, and then crime in the inner city, and, you know, that school board election, maybe we don't want to fund those schools, and, you know, and then things kind of start to revert back to the status quo. Cause like, I think a lot about Bill Russell, one of the greatest NBA players and champions of all time, played in Boston. They threw bricks through that man's window.
Yeah.
He was winning championships. Like, it wasn't like he was and underperforming.
South Africa is an aggressive place, you know, and what I mean by that is like some of the things that you experience there, which is very jarring. I have not been back in a number of years, but I assume not significant change. I mean, and they do have a weak economy and, you know, their rand, which is their currency, could be doing better, and they have crime. Okay, all of that. But the things like living there, which wasn't too, you know, not a ridiculous number of years after, you know, I lived there between the time of when this World Cup was and when the film was made, right? Yeah. That's the time frame that I lived in there. And so there were things that I found really shocking and that felt aggressive. So open carry weapons, right? Like there would be sometimes white people that would have a gun on their hip. You know, I mean, here in the United States, yes, there are places that have like open carry guns. Frankly, I haven't really witnessed that too much other than like police officers having open carry guns, but like a civilian with a gun on their hip. And I don't even know if that's legal or not legal, but to me, the impression was it was a white guy with a gun who gets to carry a gun on his hip and do whatever.
Right. And then it's a completely different set of circumstances versus.
Yeah. And like one time there was this guy with like a gun on his hip, and he was like, you know, I don't know if he lived in my apartment building or was just visiting. I did not get on the elevator with that man.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I do not want to be on an elevator with random white man with a gun on his hip who, yeah, you might have smiled at me, but like, I don't know if you're, you know, going to rape me or shoot me, or maybe that's not your plan, but I don't need to be alone with somebody that has a gun, right? And so I'll say that was like one aggressive thing. The other aggressive thing is you drive around in South Africa, a lot of the wealthy people, right, that have private security for their homes and have these huge signs that say armed response, right? So they're just letting you know that if you are somehow perceived or an actual like interloper intruder, you're about to get shot.
It's a stand your ground situation.
And you're going, so armed response, open carry weapons.
Well, but this movie would have you believe that the worst white person in South Africa, maybe Matt Damon's dad, who just wasn't a big Nelson Mandela fan, or maybe the guy who threw the beer at Nelson Mandela at that football game.
He all
the
other white people,
or the people who don't care to learn the anthem that are on the team.
Yeah, you know, but that's what the people in South Africa are dealing with, and it's like.
That's
well,
the big racism.
Actually,
right. And the worst was really like de Klerk, right? When they show the scene of de Klerk, who was the architect of, you know, the contemporary iteration of apartheid, contemporary as in the time of the film. Yes.
Yes.
But to your point, Jordan, I get it. Yeah. There's, it's not like when you're watching 12 Years a Slave and it's clear who is the extreme white supremacist, racist, or Django Unchained with the Leonardo DiCaprio character with the Mandingo fighting and all of these like terrible things with Candyland, right? Like, that's not, you know, there is no such character that is this terrible person.
Well, but it also is, I think, in a sense, juxtaposing Black outrage and anger in the movie, where you're kind of like, these white people don't seem so bad. Why are these Black people so upset about, you know, even Nelson Mandela's daughter is like, I think you're doing a bad job and I don't like you. And you're just like, oh, what? What's happening?
And Winnie is nowhere to be seen.
Nowhere right? to be seen. Yeah, there you go. He flirts with someone
at an event, right? Yep. And there's no Winnie. You know?
Well, it's kind of laid out. His security guard is like, how's your family? And he's like, I have 42 million family members. I'm sad now. I'm going home. And going then, home. You know, his other guy's like, don't ask him about his family.
Don't bring him up the family. He can't see him.
I guess here's the bigger question.
Could this film, like, how could this film have been better?
Well, I think that's a good question about reimagining the movie. And I think when you look at this film, we say this all the time, when it's a true event, when it's a true story, obviously, like, just removing white people is not an option, because they were there, they're on the rookie team, like, they're a part of this conversation, right? Like, you don't necessarily have to eliminate them, but it's a very strange movie that seems to, we're going to get to some Clint Eastwood quotes in just a minute, but like, Mandela is deified in a way that I think doesn't do him a lot of service, because it's not that you need to know all the ugly, you know, parts of his life, but like a fuller picture of, again, why was he in prison? He wasn't in prison for just not agreeing with the government. Like,
it has a significant amount of erasure of history and context, right? It's just literally whitewashed that it was a completely repressive regime. I mean, for me, if I'm going to watch a movie that's on the heels of an apartheid system and regime, I want to see some of the terrible stuff that happened to the people. I want to see, you know, maybe the lead up to this World Cup era film show what got Mandela in prison in the first place, what he endured in prison while he was there, and, you know, what were some of the impacts on people's lives that meant that they didn't have access to opportunity. They weren't even having access to the resources and wealth in their own country. You know, you had people that were tortured and killed and oppressed. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Well, I'd go a step further and say that those things give not just context, but stakes. And that's why the movie feels flat, because there is no, I mean, we all understand racism is bad, right? We all know apartheid was bad. You don't have to tell us those things, but we do need context in the sense of the story, right? Because otherwise, anything that happened before the story could have been absolutely anything. I'm just thinking as far as like the audience member. It could have been Pinocchio before this. It could have been Star Wars before this, before the film starts. It's just how the human psyche works. It's how the human brain works when you watch a movie. We don't necessarily want to see like violence, you know, beget upon a person, but we do need context for the story. And because we don't get like, honestly, any, even that first scene where he's jogging and we're supposed to feel that there's an assassination looming, even though we ultimately know if we've read any books.
Because he lived to 2012 or something, right?
Exactly.
You know that they don't get him. But you know what? I'll also say this, what I think is really important and critical. So in terms of like not just having context and having erasure, and we watched a 15-year-old film, and that, you know, the three of us have some knowledge about what happened there, the person who picks up the film, who that, you know, mentioned before, that doesn't have the context, is going to think that is what it was.
Yep.
And so what it means is these kinds of films are actually very dangerous, right? They are a vector for a revisionist history of what took place in society, right? Yeah. And what happened with apartheid, which is the same kind of things that we see with the films here in the United States, right? That take place here in the United States. And so what you see is, you know, let's say a 15-year-old watches this movie, they're going to think that things weren't that bad and not understand it all. Right. And so that is doing disservice for a film that was a poor film in its time.
Yep.
And it's even more ridiculous in terms of looking at it in the context of carrying through time. And, you know, and I could also extrapolate to this or this sort of like revisionist history of like what took place, just even thinking of, and granted, I like this series because I am a sucker for a period piece, but Bridgerton, right? I like Bridgerton. And if you think of like that series and how frankly ignorant a lot of people are about history and context, that there are a lot of people that could watch something like that and be like, you'll be like, oh, like in the 1700s, like black people and white people were getting along just fine in England. And look,
there were black queens. There were black queens in England. What are you talking about?
Right. Right. So they'll see those things and think, or, you know, when they think of Gone with the Wind, right, in the past, it's like, oh, you know, in fact, it reminds me. Okay. Reminds me of a story. When I was in college, and I went to Wellesley, and I was doing junior year abroad. I lived in the south of France, and there was like a student, you know, place that Wellesley had for us. We could all hang out. So I'm hanging out in our like Aix-en-Provence hangout center. And there's this woman who, you know, well-intentioned white woman, classmate of mine. And you know how they just love to romanticize mm-hmm. about the past, like this antebellum past. And ooh. She was, you know, so I'm sitting there, she's sitting there, and then other classmates are sitting there just hanging out. And she says, you know, Fatima, do you ever think about what it had been like to live in the past? You know, like in the 1800s, you know, like Scarlett O'Hara, you know, she's asking me like from that time frame. I'm like, no, you know, I, and she's like not picking up on my hints. No, I don't think I would not have wanted to live in the past. Why would I want to live in the past when we didn't have vaccines on the same level? Healthcare wasn't the same. The likelihood that we would die in childbirth was really high. You know, I'm coming up with various, no, but don't you just think, and she's sort of like romanticizing. And as she keeps going, it's like you could hear a pin drop because everyone stops doing what they're doing. And they're like paying attention to this conversation because they're like, okay, Becky here is not picking up on the hints. And then I've tried how to be as diplomatic as I can. And she keeps going in because she's somehow thinking, you know, Rhett Butler is about to just sweep her off her feet in her corset and her hoop skirt. And I finally say to her, no, I wouldn't want to live in the past so that I could be your slave.
I mean, I went to high school. I was in middle school. We used to play that game when we were in middle school. But what time period would you have liked to live in? I would have loved to see the 1920s. I would have loved to see the 17th. I would have loved to got here when we got to America and all this stuff. And it's like, literally, I was a slave in like all of your little fantasies.
All the scenarios.
Or like I was subjugated in all of your fantasies until the 1970s. So
I picked the present as messed up as it is with democracy in peril. I will still take this situation here and now. Yeah.
Well, let's travel back to the past just for a little bit to hear from director of Invictus, Clint Eastwood, in 2009 in an interview with GQ magazine, had some things to say that I think might be a little bit interesting to look upon now. He's asked, why Invictus? Why now? And he responds, I'm not an objective party, but the world needs this kind of story nowadays. It's just everybody's so screwed up. Nobody knows where they're heading. It seems like our country is in kind of a morbid mood because the recession or whatever. I think our politicians could learn a lot from Mandela. And then the interviewer asks, what do you think they could learn? And he says, about racial relationships and such. It just seems like we're making a lot of mistakes on this whole thing, calling everybody racist. Everybody's calling everybody morons and nuts, and we're becoming more juvenile as a nation. The guys who won World War II and that whole generation, they've disappeared. And now we have a bunch of teenage twits. People 50 years old acting like that. In Gran Torino, I play a guy who's racially offensive, but he learned, and it shows that you're never too old to learn and embrace people that you didn't understand to begin with. It seems like nobody's got that message, I guess. So
Man invokes his own movie. He was like, well, I'm doing the work. I don't know if you've heard of a little movie called Gran Torino where I saved a little Mexican boy.
Like, and he's done like several of these. Like, wasn't he one like The Mule or like he was right? He's done like
he did two in a row. The Gran Torino and The Mule. Or, yeah.
And then he did El Camacho.
Oh, yeah. Cry Macho.
Cry Macho. That was the trifecta.
You know,
my guy had a trilogy.
Mm-hmm. The White Savior trilogy. Mm-hmm.
He really did.
I like his point here.
Watch Cry Macho soon.
Yeah. It just seems like we're making a lot of mistakes on this whole calling everybody racist, which I immediately picked up on and said, who's saying what now? Be more specific about it.
He put Danny Glover in one movie and was like, hey, y'all, I like y'all, all right? I like y'all. I put Danny Glover in Unforgiven. He wasn't even supposed to be there, y'all. I'm everybody's friend.
Well, here's the key quote that I want us to unpack for a second. Interviewer asks, do you hope that people will look at this movie and learn anything? And our boy Clint Eastwood responds, well, they'll take it on a lot of levels. It seems like we're stepping on our dicks all the time. Jimmy Carter accusing people who disagree with the president of being racist. The president sides with the black professor rather than the policeman. Everybody's just ready to jump down everybody else's throats. You know, sure, that was a mistake because Obama started out perfectly. I don't have the facts. That was the time to stop. Carter is just kind of a senile old guy, I guess. And it's something about being an old guilty Southerner that makes you want to be perceived as doing penance for all the years you probably cast a lot of aspersions on black people when you were younger or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's just not a fair judgment, but it seems like that's what we're doing. Those are just two examples. What we're doing on both sides of the political spectrum, right and left, is just yelling at each other. I look at the TV, and if you disagree with somebody, you're a fucking fruitcake, moron, screwball, stuff like that. We can be much more tolerant of people if we want to, but the extremists on both sides are the ones who ruin it for the rest of us. There's too much transmission and very little reception. You watch MSNBC or Fox, they're not listening. They're just talking all over each other. Very few people, when you watch, really let a person finish their thought. They just want to stop them down right away, like a bug. Step on it before it bites you. I won't go on the shows for that one reason. I've always considered myself a social libertarian. Leave everybody alone. Quit trying to force everybody down everybody's throat. But maybe that's me. Maybe that's just dreaming in this world today. So he had
okay.
He did not come for Jimmy Carter.
Yep. Yeah, he did.
Who is like honestly, I feel like Jimmy Carter is like my favorite president. But he did not come for Jimmy Carter. Jimmy, I'm not trying
Obama.
To say that the man
back
is perfect.
Yeah, and
but
Obama.
That man, if ever there is a testament to someone who has dedicated his life to the betterment of other people, who eradicated the guinea worm, okay? Sorry, that's just so off the charts.
And by the way, it's also, sorry, I said Danny Glover, it's Morgan Freeman, he put him on Unforgiven. Yeah. So Clint Eastwood only knows one black person. but my point being that Clint Eastwood kind of does this thing where racism exists in his films because he does acknowledge them in Unforgiven and in The Mule and the trifecta that we spoke of earlier and this. But it is his direction. It is his idea that the violence was extreme, right? The violence and the subjugation and the laws put in place were extreme. And, you know, the conversation we're continuing to have is extreme, but apparently he's ultimately a humanist, so the problem, so there's no,
well,
real
no, he's
problem,
a social libertarian, and Cameron.
Oh, my fault. Yeah. sorry, let me register him as a social libertarian or whatever the crap
what
he
means,
thinks he is.
Social,
yeah,
that's
leave everybody that's, alone, I guess, is his answer.
I mean,
to life.
I don't understand, right? What the social part before it, but what I like to say, you know, not a quote I didn't invent this one, but I heard it somewhere. Everyone's a libertarian until their town needs a bailout.
Right.
I'm about to say, man, like,
although I'm not a libertarian, but I'm just saying, you know, let the flood come to Clint Eastwood's house, and all of a sudden he's gonna be like, why isn't the government helping with the flood?
But somebody in Clint Eastwood's place has been making movies for so many years. He ain't got no problems. He has no real issues. This is also people who are in positions of privilege telling us about experiences that the masses have.
Yes.
Which is just like so confusing, right? I've always, I was saying to a friend yesterday, like, I don't want to watch movies about racism by white people. I don't ever want to watch them.
Sorry, Cameron. That's what the show is about.
It is.
Well, I think before we get out of the behind the scenes history part of this, one thing I will mention, a lot of these movies, we look at them and they're totally fabricated. There's a lot of things thrown in there that are not true. This movie, very much to the real events that happened, probably maybe almost to its detriment in a way where it's just very much so, this is what happened point by point, you know, no dramatic points. But there is one thing that they left out. South Africans aren't upset about this. New Zealanders, very upset about this, because apparently during that World Cup match, right before the match, the night before, most of the team came down with food poisoning after eating food from the hotel that they were at. Only two people did not, and they were the two people that ate outside of the hotel. And so there is theory, suspicion, conspiracy theory that
I see where you're going.
Part of what happened was the team got maybe food poisoning from the hotel. And so during the match, you know, like, because they, I don't remember the guy's name, but there's the Maori player that everybody's afraid of because he's like the best rugby player that ever lived, yada yada. And they're able to kind of contain him during this match, and they make it seem like it's just literal the will of the South African people lifting this team up to win.
But it sounds like what he needed to be uplifted by was Pepto-Bismol,
right? And so, you know, I guess what had happened throughout the rest of the tournament is that New Zealand, because they were going down the stats to Mandela, and one of them was like 145 to like six, and he was like 145 points, goddamn.
I mean, they're an amazing, I mean, I can't speak for the 1995 team, but the New Zealand Blacks are really impressive.
Yeah,
you know, and the women too. Like, I'm really excited that rugby is in the Olympics as of the last Olympics, and they played rugby seven, so it's not like these long drawn out matches. It's like 7 minutes and then 7 minutes and boom, it's over. Yeah. So it's not much of a commitment like it is to like basketball or soccer or something.
Yeah.
But they are always like the team to beat, or maybe like Fiji or something like that. But you know, I look forward to being able to see the New Zealand Blacks play a game.
Well, I'm sure
that's the team I root for, and frankly, I want them to win in the Olympics.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been catering ever since for them. No
hotel food. Probably bring in their own food, you know.
It was food poisoning for freedom.
Yes,
before
for freedom.
Exactly. Right.
As we get out of here, Fatima, we now have to turn to two things. One, what was the general reception to this movie? And we're going to play our favorite game where we go to all the aggregate review sites and look at what Invictus currently has. And we're going to start with one, imdb.com. Out of 10, and there's a point system, what do you think Invictus currently has out of 10 on IMDb?
Right, because it could change over time, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it out of 10? I'm just going to assume that there are a whole bunch of white people that watch it and rate it maybe an 8.
Okay. Cameron, what do you think?
Yeah, that feels accurate, but I'm going to go 6, like
6.8. 7.3. Okay. 7.3 out of 167,000 ratings. So, yeah. As we go along, I mean, I won't read a lot from these reviews, but a lot of them are the same. Inspirational, uplifting, you know what I mean? Incredible
His racism
performance
was
from,
solved.
yes, you know, but like we
Yo,
said,
that kid with the coke out front, man, that
a
said
little
it
bit of
all.
absolvement. That's the one thing I will say.
So the woman that hugged you, Cameron, rated it a 10.
Yeah.
You go. She went home and watched this. She went home after the play and she watched Invictus, gave it a 10.
In fact, she was Invictus, right? Like the victor or whatever, undefeated. Yeah, that's where it was.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, it's the parts that were true to history, you know what I mean? Like, very down the line. The parts where you could tell this is just Clint Eastwood riffing, like the cop and the kid and like all these other moments. It's like, now we're kind of stepping on it. Now we're kind of getting out of pocket a bit.
Yeah. How did they even pick Clint Eastwood? Did he produce it?
It was a situation where originally Morgan Freeman wanted to do Long Walk to Freedom, but he was having a hard time figuring out the best way to adapt it. And, you know, he and Clint Eastwood obviously worked together on Unforgiven, still had a friendly relationship. I think they also did Million Dollar Baby together. And yep. So Morgan, looking to get the movie done, he had read the book that this was based on and probably knew, hey, you know who could probably get this movie made? Clint Eastwood. So, you know, he came to Clint Eastwood with this script, and Clint Eastwood took it to Warner Brothers and they're like, we love it, let's make this movie immediately. So, because the book came out in 2008, the movie came out in 2009. So, like,
that's quick.
Oh, see,
they got it. They went in. Yeah. Going over to Rotten Tomatoes, what do you think out of 100% Invictus currently has?
I don't know who are the people that tend to rate.
Rotten Tomatoes is more of the critics, like professional critics and reviewers.
60% rather.
Cameron?
Price is Right rules. I'll say 65.
76% certified fresh.
Dang.
I was going to go for back to where I was before, but then when you said like the critics, I thought they would be more critical.
Well, again, nope. It had all of those nominations.
You know what? I should have tempered my response thinking about the same kind of people that nominate and vote for the Golden Globes and the Oscars that need to be diversified.
I was about to say, didn't Crash win Best Picture in like 2006 or something like 2005?
This is pre-Oscar So White. That's so still.
Right. They still think Crash solved racism like 3 years before that. So,
but I guess ludicrous. You know, these ratings, I guess they adjust over time. But I guess maybe not too many people are going back and looking at it and rereading.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last one. All right. Our absolute favorite. We're looking at Amazon.com, where I unfortunately had to watch this movie. What do you think Invictus currently has out of 5 stars on Amazon?
3.
Cameron,
he's gonna go 4. He's gonna price this right.
Yeah, I hate to do this every. It's like 4.7, ain't
Where
it?
Where is Bob Barker?
Literally 4.7, Cam. You're right on.
Oh my god,
7 out of 5.
I just trailed. You know, damn. Well, then because it's like, who's watching it? Because we're not really watching this movie.
Yeah, Amazon is the
people.
Yeah, it's the free market of.
Yeah, but I mean, how many reviews does it have?
4,023 global ratings.
Yeah.
So this Amazon is also a place where people will say 5 stars, disc in working condition.
You know what? The people that rated this are the same people that put the raisins, you know, in the potato salad.
Well,
it's very. They was probably eating a bowl of it while watching Invictus.
That's what the critics thought. But now it's time to rate this movie on our personal Caucasity ranking scale. For Timo, we've got 3 levels of Caucasity to rate this movie on. The first level of Caucasity is shorts in the winter. It is still cold outside, and it is something that you can't escape. Did you see this tweet recently, Cameron? It was like a picture of Tia Mari, like just making the steak face. And it's like, when you're walking down the street in 40 degree weather, like bundled up, and then you see a white man in shorts. And it's like, yeah, that's the that's
Oh, I
it,
didn't
you
see
know,
that.
where this is not hurting us. It's more of a curiosity. What is it inside of you that compels you to put on a full goose down bubble coat and then proceed to put on like knee length shorts?
And
And
flip flops.
sandals and
Yes.
be flip
And flip
flops on the way to the
flops.
bodega.
Yes, not just picking up the mail or, you know, but like outside living life in shorts in 40 or below. I mean, there
So
could be snow on
shorts,
the
okay,
ground.
so a rating is shorts in the winter,
That's
which me
the first level.
that's the first
okay.
level, and that's this is a curiosity. No harm is being done to us, but we are kind of confused about why this got made. Cameron, what's the second level?
Harm done to us, meaning black people.
Yes.
Yes.
Or just generally people of color. Yeah.
Okay.
Honestly. And second level of caucasity is this movie is touching my hair. So now there's a light violence going on. You know, there's an access to your personal space. You know, they probably didn't ask. You know, they said your hair is a little curlier than usual. I would love to know that texture, but before they've even finished the question, they're already several knuckles deep in your scalp. You know, something you would never do because you got human decency, but they just want to know. And at that point, it's like it is a problem. It is sort of even a violence. But not necessarily like something you can't handle, something that's not like hyper problematic. It's just a problem. And the third level.
Third level this week, Fatima, is specifically for you. We picked these out because we knew you were coming on. If you haven't seen recently, just this week, there two specific articles came out about two very interesting DEI decisions that have been made across the country. One, the University of Florida announced that it is eliminating all positions
Yes.
related to diversity, equity, inclusion, following a new Florida Board of Governors regulation that labels expenses related to DEI as prohibited expenditures. The regulation says a state university may not expend or state any federal funds to promote, support, or maintain any programs or campus activities that violate Section 1005 of Florida statutes, advocate for what it defines as diversity, equity, and inclusion, or promote or engage in what it defines as political or social activism. All right. So a major American university has eliminated the entirety of its DEI department based on some fuckery from Ron DeSantis. If that wasn't enough, this is an article from Bloomberg that says Wall Street basically is pulling out of DEI entirely. From C-suits down, American finance is quietly reassessing its promises to level the playing field. The growing conservative assault on DEI, coupled with pockets of resentment among white employees, have executives moving to head off accusations of reverse discrimination. It's not just Wall Street. In recent weeks, Zoom video communications, which we are recording this on as we speak, cut its internal DEI
Yep.
team amid broader layoffs, and Tesla removed language about minority workers from a regulatory filing. Bank of New York, for instance, is reconsidering its decision to tie executive compensation to progress on diversity, according to people familiar with the matter. The lender has also changed the language it uses to describe its diversity and inclusion initiative in recent months, eliminating references to specific targets around diversity and inclusion. Bank of America has tweaked some DEI programs and the way it talks about them, according to people familiar with the changes. The lender has considered ending some of its mentorship programs because they have achieved their goals and may no longer be needed.
Yeah. Oh,
One of the people
so like
said
Invictus, they figured it out. They
they
figured
did
it
it.
out at Bank of America.
JP Morgan summer fellowships for Black undergraduate sophomores is now open to all sophomore students, regardless of background. And at Goldman Sachs, lawyers have advised senior executives to remove references to race and gender in college recruitment programs, according to people familiar with the matter. They've also warned against hosting exclusive events for specific groups, such as women and people of color. One exec says she's had a white woman ask what opportunities their sons will have if Wall Street continues to focus on promoting underrepresented groups.
Yeah, I've
Word.
read about both of those, and including that Bloomberg article. And in reading the Bloomberg article, you know, I was like, profiles in no courage, right? This is where all of these people are.
Right,
And, you know,
right.
like, oh, okay, so we're just going to create a program to bring in more white men. That's effectively, which means you
Yeah.
don't even need a program. You could just get rid of the whole thing and
So
just go
just,
back to what you had before. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, very
And
problematic.
that's
That's the,
level three.
yeah. And that's, you know
right. So level
exactly what you're
three is
doing.
DEI retrenchment and you know, DeSantis.
Yes, and that's the level where you know exactly what you're doing. There is no subtext, there is no subtlety. This is a violence intended. And there's maybe even some enjoyment of it. Like, you're doing it on purpose. You want everybody.
Well, I mean, that's a high bar, because that sort of like white nationalism unwinding, or even like, you know, what's happening now where the attack on DEI, part of the language being used is DEI is anti-Semitic, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's mm-hmm. supposed to be a thing too, you know, which is so not true. Where I see an attack on DEI as being an attack on Black people and an attack on people of color, mm-hmm. and that they'll, you know, come for everybody eventually. But, you know, it's so, in, you know, extreme, the level. So it's hard for me to think about it in terms of this film, because it's like that level of just sort of like this complete unwinding of the 20th century is more like, do I see this film as being as harmful as Birth of a Nation?
Right.
Right. And yeah. So basically the level are Birth of a Nation, you know, Don't Touch My Hair, and Fools Out in the Cold.
Yes. Where do you think Invictus might land on that scale?
I think it is Don't Touch My Hair creeping into Birth of a Nation, because the reason why I say that, it's like, it's not as extreme in your face as the Birth of a Nation, but these kinds of films are the things that chip away bit by bit to never enable the ability to truly tackle racism, right? So like one of the things I say in my book, I say that, you know, good white people, white liberals and Democrats can be dangerous racists, and somehow, and can also be more dangerous than the white nationalist person, because the white nationalists, they know who they are,
mm-hmm.
right? And they're less right. numerous. What is more numerous, which therefore upholds the system for the DeSantis to be where he is, are the people that just tacitly, casually are silent, complicit, do their nice racism, and that upholds the broader white supremacist racial caste system. Yep. So it's right. Touching My Hair creeping into Birth of a Nation, because it's really masked Birth of a Nation in a new package, not realizing they've gone full hood.
Right. Cam, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree. This is definitely Touching My Hair 0.5. Yeah, it is that chipping away. It is that like light erasure, you know, because I mean, this is something I dealt with in, you know, grade school, which is like, it couldn't have been that bad, or this problem, that wasn't really a problem, or, you know, specifically I went to, you know, all white school or majority white school outside of Baltimore, Maryland. So majority Black city, right outside of it, majority white high school and, you know, grade school, whatnot. And, you know, my classmates throughout would say things like, oh, this wasn't that bad, or, you know, it couldn't have been that bad, or
you misunderstood.
It wasn't that devious. Yeah. You might misunderstand it. And it is that chipping away that allows them to feel secure in saying that. But if we keep watching movies like this, and especially in the days that we live in now, with media literacy being like literally an all-time low, we're just watching people just misunderstand movies, television, books they read, literally cultural phrases. Woke had been literally co-opted from the black lexicon, right? So it's that kind of behavior that lets a movie like Invictus seem like
or
it's
more
doing
like
the work.
Infectus.
Ooh,
okay.
Ooh, hit him.
Right, because what they're doing is they're just planting that subliminal message. Planting the seed, infecting like a mental, cerebral, earworm kind of a thing that just percolates. And then therefore, right. you're like, you know, oh, yes, Can you please serve me some more oppression? Thank you.
Right. It's not. It's not telling you why Nelson Mandela is in jail, right? It's not showing you real consequences of apartheid.
In fact, if you think about it, for all you know, he could have been a mass murderer because there is so little information about why he
that
was
is actually being doled out
in prison that he could have been a serial killer. And he served his time, and then he got out, and that's why all the people are glaring at him and thinking that he's terrible, not because he's dismantling their apartheid regime of a racialized caste system and systemic oppression, you know, with their apartheid system. No, it's that he was like this convict, and all he did was just chip away at rocks, okay, as his penitence.
Yo, that scene is forever egregious now. I can't even believe it happened.
Ghost Mandela.
Ghost Mandela.
Yeah, I will agree with you, and I'll let another historical figure speak to this moment and say.
And a lot of white folk have demonstrated eloquently that they don't have no sense.
Because this is one of those movies where...
it's true. They have demonstrated that they got no sense.
It's
go
it's
ahead. That was Martin Luther King, right? That sounded like his voice.
Yeah.
Got it.
Which I play that to again link back to, you know, white people are like, oh man, you know, Martin Luther King, what a great activist. Totally. Who really changed the world, and like we love him so much. And like, let me quote him today on his day to you know, express, and it's
put
like
it in your throat, in your face. Which keep going. I'm trying to find another recent quote that I found from King that I just love, but keep going.
But you know, but then you go back to the archival footage and you're like spitting on him.
Mm-hmm. True.
As he's marching in the street.
So and he only love had that something much. Like you 12. No, you think at the time he had something like 15 to 20% of like approval.
Yes.
Right. Like, and then somehow everyone's like, oh, he was like, everybody loved him. He was like, great. It's like,
we gave him a day.
We gave him we gave him a bullet.
The government gave him a day, and they also gave him that bullet too.
Oh, okay. You reading that quote made me think of this recent quote that I heard of Martin Luther King. Whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent.
And I think when you think about Mandela, like a lot of people look at him in a similar light, and they're like, oh, what a great man who just he just loved everyone, so much love in his heart, no anger, never was mad, always loving,
Nobel Peace Prize, just
forgiving everyone.
Yep.
The man turned to an armed revolution because you would not give him the freedom that he was asking for,
right?
You know what I mean? And there's always a sanitized version, and this is very much always a sanitized version of him, as again, like, do we need every single moment of his life in here to really, you know, get a full account? Not necessarily, but like, can we get something? Can we get some idea of who he was besides the guy who forgave white people of everything? Like the way that they, again, tried to make it seem like he just came out of jail and was like, sorry, everyone's sorry. I'm sorry that, you know, this happened. Everybody, let's just move past. Come together.
I'll say this about Martin Luther King, right? So when I was younger, I was like, okay, Martin Luther King, he's okay. But I wasn't that wild about him. Mm-hmm. And the reason why was because I was always like, well, I'm more Martin than Malcolm. You know, and thinking about like my approach to things, not that Malcolm X was violent, but in the sense of like, well, self-defense. And then as I got older and started to research Martin Luther King more, right, because the impression was that all he wanted to do was sing Kumbaya, walk across a bridge, holding hands with a bunch of, you know, in a rainbow coalition. And talk about the mountaintop, right? So like, that's how he sold in many respects. But then when I got older and then started to research, I was like, oh no, he was radical.
Yep.
He was way more radical. And in fact, he and Malcolm very much agree on many things and say very similar things, just packaged somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. but were very aligned, especially towards the end of both of their lives, you know? And so I find that, very interesting. And when people do bring up Martin Luther King, I try to remind them or illuminate and say, no. He was not the mountaintop man. That was not what he stood for. What he stood for were things like reparations and atoning and solving and dismantling.
Well, and that's a lot of the same things that Nelson Mandela stood for. And in the same way, this movie is trying to make him seem like he just wanted to watch some rugby, y'all. Let him pull up
Right.
the ESPN app and
Let the old
just,
man get his, get his rugby on, two
And that,
steps from a diaper, like let him do his thing.
but like you were saying, Fatima, if you're 15 years old, if they show Invictus in school, as you're doing your Nelson Mandela, report, and you watch this movie, and you're like, well, all right, I get it. It's like, well, you're missing like a large chunk of the story, and so that's why I agree. This movie isn't quite third level, all the way
It's not
destructive,
Birth of a Nation,
but it
but
is.
there's a there, it's beyond the hair petting.
Yeah, there's certainly, even if, Clint Eastwood doesn't admit straight up that there was an agenda behind this movie, I think there was certainly, in the erasure and the absence of certain things, I think there was intentionality, and so like he can try to skate around it and bring up social libertarianism for he's talking about, but it's like I see you. I know, this wasn't, you didn't leave out Winnie on by accident. There are certain things that you missed probably because you didn't know how to tackle that subject. So,
And if you are a person who truly is trying to advance racial equality and trying to form stronger, more positive relationships across race, if that is what Clint Eastwood is supposedly truly about, then he
right.
would not have shown up at that Republican convention speaking to that empty chair. Because anyone that would do that, and wasn't that a Trump era convention?
I think Trump maybe was
Was
there. This
right
was
before.
this, yeah,
Was
was
it
this right
pre-Trump?
before?
So then it was like
I
Mitt
would say
Romney.
campaign.
Yeah. This might have been
I
second
don't
term
remember when the.
Obama.
Okay, fine, right. But the point is if you can look at his public statements that are political, and you can look at his career of movie making and the messages that are sent, not just when he's an actor, but when he's a director and a producer, and what he is sending out is this repeated fake racial harmony, which is what this film is also that he created, right? This fake racial harmony while I deliver to you racism. So I've packaged my racism in faux unity, faux togetherness, erasure of reality, milk toast, bland, don't question anything. We are all singing kumbaya. I just showed up with my tambourine at the drumming circle, but don't drum too hard because that's going to interfere with my libertarianism.
Well, I think we've gotten to the bottom of Invictus here. Fatima, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming
Yes,
on and
thank
talking with
you.
us. This has been great. Please tell everybody where they can find the book, anything that you have going on that you want people to know about, where they can find you on social media, all of that good stuff.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. I truly, truly enjoyed this. I love the whole, let's tackle a movie, which is why I said I was all in and was like, oh no, we don't have to just talk about my book. I want to, this sounds like a lot of fun, and it was a lot of fun. So thank you guys both. In terms of where people can find me, they can go to fatimagilliam.com, FatimaGilliam.com, which is where you can find all my social media handles, for Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And I encourage people to buy my book. And if they're going to buy my book, they could do one of two things. One is support a local Black-owned bookstore. And then they could also please ask for the book at your library so that it gets to more places and spaces. I encourage people to gift the book to someone in their life that they think needs to learn, because books are really, they grow by word of mouth and by sharing. I'll also say that when you go to my website, and if you know people read the book, there's additional material there that people can download. So if they get together in a book club, there are, you know, conversation, guidelines there. And there's also additional information, like my voting rights chapter. I talk about like an overview of the history of voter suppression in the United States, and I couldn't fit it all in the book. So there's like a long, you know, taking you back from like the 1770s. And, you know, close to the present, so people can get that information. And what I also say is I encourage people to write a review on Amazon, because that's really important for the algorithm, for it to show up in other people's searches. So, you know, get the book, share the book, talk about the book, learn from the book, gift the book, and enjoy the book.
And once again, that book is Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Will Tell You. Buy a copy, leave it in the break room. You don't have to, you know.
There you go.
Just drop it off at a whole bunch of police stations.
Yeah.
Just, I was about to say, they don't got to know it's you.
Yeah.
They ain't got to know it was you. Surprise gift.
Cameron, tell everybody where they can find you and what you got going on.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and IG at TheBlipster1138. Cooking things right now, working on a couple projects. Hopefully I'll have something to talk about later this year. But for now, maybe you could go to Key TV on YouTube. That's Kiki Palmer's YouTube television network situation going over there. I wrote on their recent web series, The Psychological Evolution of Fuckboys. I wrote episode 3. Watch that one a lot. Just watch it like a million times. Just leave it on loop all night. Yeah, do the Bieber and just leave it on all night. And then I can tell my boss that I wrote the funniest episode.
Yeah. And I'm Jordan Clark. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at JRSOSA18, JRSOSA18. You can also find the show on Twitter at white_pod. And you can write to us at whitepeoplewon'tsaveyoupod@gmail.com. We might have a live show coming up. So if you are in the Baltimore area, April 26th, maybe, fingers crossed. We're still working out the details, but you might fingers be able crossed. To catch us live if you're in the area. So come and check us out. But that's going to do it for us this week.
Working we'll on back. Brooklyn too.
Hey, well, we're getting around. We won't be around. So just keep those ears open. But that's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back with more Caucasity soon. Peace.
Peace.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.
You can't save us.
We don't want to be saved.